Balance your trading strategy by adding futures. CME Group helps you manage risk and capture opportunities in all market environments. Capitalize on around-the-clock access to highly liquid global futures and options market across all major asset classes. Just visit your online broker and get started. Plug into valuable educational materials and trading tools and see what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/onthetape. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, SALT iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io.
When you're trading options, Fidelity has just what you need, with straightforward but powerful tools to help you select a strategy and execute your ideas. And they offer a wide range of information and insights to help simplify your trading experience. Have a question? Ask it live during their small classes and coaching sessions. Need information? Check out their educational videos, articles, and webinars. See why it's easy to trade options your way at Fidelity. Start now at fidelity.com/options.
Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request. A very warm welcome to the On the Tape podcast. I am Guy Adami. That's Dan Nathan. And joining us back from vacation, the great Danny Moses. Danny Moses, how are you?
What did I miss? Did I miss some action?
You know, it's funny you say that, and we're going to get into that in a second. But before, I just want to say hello to Dan Nathan. Dan.
Hi, Guy.
This is, as I mentioned, On the Tape podcast. And stick around, because after the three of us chat about the markets, we have a conversation with Managing Director of R.W. Baird, the great Ben Callow. You know Ben from his coverage of Tesla and other stocks, so I'm sure that will be an animated conversation, Dan Nathan. But as we're sitting here today on a Thursday afternoon, by the way, we have found ourselves on the Instagram. Dan?
Yeah.
You are what?
I'm Dan's Nathan.
Dan S. Dan Nathan. S. Nathan.
Yeah. You're Guy Dadadami.
I'm Guy Adami, yes.
Guy Dadadami.
I'm not sure if Danny Moses has found us. Danny, have you found your way onto the gram?
I'm on Instagram. I haven't had my coming out party yet on it, so I'll work on that
with you
please.
Guys. I think that's important, because we need to enrich our social media presence. But earlier today, and when I say today, we tape our podcast on Thursdays. I want to be crystal clear.
Yeah.
Thursday, April 4th. Now, you're listening to this most likely Friday the 5th, or maybe on Saturday the 6th. I don't know. But earlier today, Thursday, I put out on the gram, today is a day where you could see a big reversal in the broader market. And people looked at me like, you're out of your mind, which is true. The S&P 500 on Thursday, which is again today, traded up to 52.56 and change. As we're sitting here right now, Dan Nathan, the S&P is 51.76 and change. That, my friends, is what?
A good old-fashioned reversal.
It's a good old-fashioned reversal. Now, I'm not saying that to pat myself on the back. Trust me, I'm wrong more than I'm right. But I mention that because over the last couple weeks, Danny Moses, and I go back to March 8th, which was a Friday, we saw some huge intraday reversals in individual stocks. Not necessarily the broader market, but on some individual stocks. Technicians call what we saw on that particular day an engulfing pattern, a key reversal. And I will tell you, since that day, although the market's traded sideways, a little higher, a little lower, some of these individual stocks a little higher, a little lower, that has not been breached, Dan Nathan. So
yeah.
As we sit here, I ask you, are we on the precipice of something? By the way, I'll also mention before I shut up for a second that we have a VIX with a 15.5 handle for the first time in quite some time.
Yeah, and interestingly, you know, we have this move index back towards 100. That thing had fallen off the bottom right of its chart. So that's a U.S. Treasury measure of volatility there. And so when you talk about this intraday reversal, guy, that we're seeing right now, Thursday into the close, we have the all-important March jobs report tomorrow morning.
I love that. Do you have to say all-important?
Yeah, 100%.
Not you.
You. I know, one.
Like everybody
one.
Said the all-important.
Yeah.
Okay,
and so I guess why is that report important? Well, the market sold off today because your boy, Neel Kashkari.
Whoa. Stop for a second.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Just stop for one second.
Not your boy.
There was an episode on CNBC back in the day. Aaron Burnett, by the way, is a very dear friend of mine.
Yeah.
Indulge me for a second.
Sure.
Okay. I knew Aaron's husband before she knew him. I worked with her husband, Dave Rubalata. Is that what they call that?
Doxing.
I'm not doxing him because it's out there in the public domain.
Yeah.
Dave worked with us at J. Aaron and Company, and he was sort of our accountant. He used to come up to the desk. What should I do? He wound up going to NYU, I believe, and then he had a storied career in Wall Street.
Nice.
So Dave met Aaron at Citibank. They got married. Okay, so guy, what are you talking about? Aaron Burnett on her show one morning had a guest on.
Neel Kashkari.
No. The gentleman's name was Hugh Johnson.
Yeah.
And she called him Huge Johnson.
Yeah.
She said, we're here now with Huge Johnson. Neel Kashkari, his name isn't Huge Johnson, but he is a Huge Johnson.
Okay.
But yes, you're going to mention the fact that on this day, it was the market turned on comments from him.
So interestingly, so Kashkari got himself a little bit of a reputation as like the eternal dove, right? As a Fed governor. And now he seems to be like the eternal hawk.
Bit of a hawk.
Yeah. So there's hawkish commentary that turned the S&P 55 handles. We haven't seen that sort of move in a while. But interestingly enough, Danny, we have yields. Okay. So the 10-year yield is at 4.30 right now. It's not even budging. So if Kashkari could move the stock market intraday like mm-hmm. that, wouldn't you think the treasury market would move, yields would move a little bit, especially when we saw yields got going earlier on this week? And what it did to stocks at that point. And I think this is what's different, at least this week, in a lot of sideways price action with some intraday volatility, is that the perception of higher yields is really sinking in. The notion that we are going to price out rate cuts, at least in the summer, is really kind of making its way, at least into the stock market psyche a little bit, Danny.
Are we clear? Crystal clear. All right. Few good men right there, just to be clear on
yes.
that. Yes, it should scare people from a bond volatility and a stock volatility perspective when just words can be taken out either in context or out of context by Fed governors. If you are buying and selling this market based upon the expectation of whether the Fed's going to cut in June or July or in September, you're doing it wrong. As long as you own companies with good fundamentals, you take advantage of sell-offs like this and buy them. Right. On the flip side of that is when you get something dovish, you take advantage and sell when it goes up. But the fact that you can move a market like this should scare everybody. And that volatility, I think we all agree, is here to stay. We've said that stocks moving up, markets moving up in a volatile manner are just as, quote, dangerous or as unsettling as things moving down. So, yes. And what does the Fed have to do? Every time we see 10-year yields creep their way to that 450 level, and I'll explain why I believe the 10-year yields are actually trading lower now, because I believe if you go higher for longer, it will have impact on the economy that will slow and 10-year yields will come in because you're self-fulfilling recession. That's neither here nor there. But the Fed is forced to come out when rates move high because of how much issuance the Treasury has mm-hmm. to make to be overtly, quote, dovish. We're here for you. I just want to remind you that we're here for you. And they do this every so often, but there is a pattern to this. And at some point when that doesn't matter anymore and people see through it, that's your danger sign, to your point. And I've always said, I will be most bearish is when 10-year yields trade down and the market trades down. That combination, when you see that thing, which will make no sense at first, since everyone's so obsessed with the 10-year, that's my fear point. Or that's when I'm going to say, okay, now you should be worried, because what is your catalyst? So if every one of these models is predicated on, 10-year yields are coming in, quant says buy, go buy stocks and go. What if that breaks? So a lot going here, but listen, huge jobs number tomorrow, but it's just a number. If it's 220, is the market going to trade down because it's 20,000 higher? If it's 180, does it trade up because it's nonsense? So bottom line is, Fed is the inflation stickier than we thought. it will abate at some point. It's certainly done, I think, going up a lot. But all the Fed is doing with this rhetoric is inflating assets. When I say assets, commodities, which are actually having an impact on the consumer.
You're correct. And let's talk about that for a second, because there's a scene in A Bronx Tale. You recall the movie?
Of course, yeah.
The great Chaz Palminteri. Yeah, big Yankee fan, by the way.
De Niro.
One of the many reasons. Yes, Robert De Niro as well.
Great movie. Now Yous Can't Leave.
Exactly. Now Yous Can't Leave. And I think that's what we found ourselves in. And I'm glad that you mentioned some of these underlying commodities, because as we sit here, Danny Moses and Dan Nathan, I know you have thoughts. You have a gold market that seemingly now on a daily basis is making an all-time high. And we'll talk about gold miners in a second and why I think the stocks can play catch up. You also have crude oil trading at levels, Dan, that we haven't seen since September, October of last year. You've had this very quiet, stealth rally in crude that nobody wants to talk about. Meanwhile, you have an OIH, which has gotten on its horse, and you have the XLE comprised basically of those three main stocks, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, and Exxon, has also gotten on its horse. And I'll throw in copper and some of the soft commodities, but let's focus right now on the two that I mentioned.
Yeah, I guess the most important part about it, you can put it all together, right? You can say the dollar has firmed up. You say that yields at least have basically firmed up, because if you're starting to price out cuts, right, in the near term, so you have upward pressure, at least neutral pressure on yields. Then if you have the commodity upward pressure, I'm looking at crude oil at $86 right now. There was an article, I don't know if you guys saw this, in the Wall Street Journal today. It was one of those interactive sort of things. It was actually doing $100 worth of groceries in 2019 and basically what you get for that in 2024. Mm-hmm. And you're going to have to basically cut out $37 worth of groceries that you would have been able to get.
Oh my God.
So
really?
So this is where I want to bring this conversation to back to the S&P 500. So if we have all of these inflationary pressures, at some point that is going to weigh on corporate margins,
yes,
right? And if corporate margins are going to start to decrease as we kind of get a sense for Q2 earnings and basically maybe what the balance of 2024 S&P earnings might look like, we know that right now consensus has for up 12% year over year at a time where all of those inflationary pressures are higher than they've been in a very long time. And most importantly, it's the narrative around them. Because if you think back to where the stock market really started getting going in mid-December is when we were pricing in six rate cuts in 2024. And I guess what, Kash Kari, your man.
No. I want to be, because somebody
not
might be coming
man.
In right
not
now. Somebody
not
might be
man.
Walking
not
into a room
man.
And they hear
God,
Dan Nathan
Sorry.
Say to Guy Adami that he's your, I want to be clear.
Not your man.
No.
Not your man. But the point here.
Johnson.
Huge Johnson. The point here is that the S&P at some point is going to have to start thinking about, okay, are we hit peak margins? Do we see an economic slowdown? And what does that kind of mean for S&P 500 earnings? And I just say that we were at 5250 in the S&P about 3 hours ago, and we're at 5175 right now, and we have a 10-year stuck right here. So that's my only point. At some point, valuation will come into play, Danny.
To have this market move. And when you talk about energy prices, you talk about oil, which has a direct effect on the consumer. You talk about stocks in the market. Let's talk about Walmart, right? I'm not going to go into it. This was the theme. If you got to spend more money on food, you need to buy some other stuff, that's where you're going. So Walmart's been capturing market share kind of from that middle income consumer that's had to kind of step down. So that's what my point is. You can find yourself owning some of these names or discount retailers or things like that because of what's been happening here within the energy sector. But when you look at oil and gasoline specifically, the impact that that's going to have on the consumer, Dan, to your point, not only does it hurt discretionary income, but your point about those input costs and all things that are going to go into the S&P, it does hurt margin. And so I think we're caught in this bind of, you know, you're damned if you do, damned if you don't, if you're the Fed. If you want to maintain this dovishness, you're going to spike a rally in all these commodities, which have a direct impact on the consumer and on input costs. You're going to pay the price somewhere. So I think that's kind of where we are. And again, on this gold guy, what is it telling us? What is gold rallying like this telling us of what's going on in the faith kind of in the markets?
Fair. I'm glad you asked me and I'll attempt to answer. So as I've said a number of times, you don't need to listen to me at all. However, when somebody like Stan Druckenmiller makes comments like he did in February, when he talks about getting into gold mining stocks, you say something, that's interesting. What does he see? You don't have to agree with him, but when somebody of that magnitude speaks, you got to listen. Then earlier this week, we heard David Einhorn on with Scott Wapner from the Irisone conference,
correct.
I believe. Am I correct?
Yeah.
Talking about his position in not only gold, but physical gold, Danny Moses, something that you talk about in the form of PHYS and other things, and his reasonings why. And I think basically what he said is sort of mirroring what we talk about. These debt levels that have gotten to levels that are unsustainable without question, and is concerned that central banks have basically, their hand is no longer firmly on the rudder of their respective economies. And I say that through the lens of not only the United States, but we talked about Japan, Danny, when nobody was talking about Japan and what was going on with their currency and the fact that the yen has weakened in a meaningful way after they raised rates for the first time in 17 years. So you have all these odd things happening, and all roads lead to gold. And gold has been rallying with interest rates going up, which historically it doesn't do. And it's been rallying with the dollar going higher, which historically it does not do. And oh, by the way, it's been rallying as Bitcoin has seemingly found a bit of a top. So they have seemingly decoupled as well. So there are a lot of reasons to like gold. People say it's toward the end of its rope here. I'll come back and say, I think we're in the very early innings of the gold market.
I agree. And I think we've seen what, correct me if I'm wrong, a $3 to $4 trillion move in the global gold market, somewhere in that realm. It's not small. If we were sitting at 11 or 12 trillion roughly when we were at 18 or 1900, we're here at 2300. That's, you know, I can do the math. I think that's about right. So that's a big move. And I agree with you. Nobody owns it. You know, I think that you're starting to see it, it's in the news flow a little bit more, but it's not even there yet. So I don't know what the Investopedia mentions are, you know, at this point, and there's a lot of ways to play it. Like you said, I play the PHYS, but you are seeing the tail on some of these ETFs like JNUG and GDX, GDXJ, JNUG, all this stuff where you're starting to see the tail. Those things are up 80 to 100% here over the last couple months. So a lot of volatility. I'm sure it'll have a maybe healthy pullback at some point, but it should scare people, or at least not scare people. People should be asking the question and learning more about it. And Guy, your point on Japan and the yen, and again, we hate to get wonky, and should you care? Probably not. But if you wake up one day and the yen is through 154 or 155 and S&P futures are down 130, and you're asking yourself, why? Why does that? Why are those two correlated at all? And it all goes back to what you said. It's gold. It's the faith in the central banks. And if you talk about Japan, what do they need to do in order to shore up their? People have saw through kind of what they did with the end of NERP, saying that they're still dovish. Try the BOE in the fall of 22, what they did. So again, we're still in this experiment. I don't want to be bearish. I just want people to understand you need to take time to figure, just try to put this puzzle together so you're not caught off guard if and when this volatility does hit these various assets.
Right. And you guys have been talking about the yen weakness. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, just to kind of break it out a second here, Guy, and maybe you can kind of expand on this, is like this has been a multi-decade trade where you are basically selling over there and basically taking the proceeds to fund higher yielding assets usually over here. And so when you talk about this yen carry trade, that's it. That's the thing. It's been a source for a lot of liquidity in our markets, and whether they're bubbly or whether they're not, right? So you take that away, that's just one of the sort of incremental buyers. I'll just say this, Danny, you also said something. I just want to push back for a second because I know you don't mean this. Tomorrow's number, again, this is, you're probably listening to this on Friday. So the March jobs report is just one number. And that's what you said. But right now we're kind of at this point where I think the macro has been a good tailwind for them, right? If you think about it, because we had this period where, you know, the Fed clearly articulated why they were raising interest rates. The stock market was basically going along for the ride as yields were going higher. The economy kept on chugging along better than everybody expected, right? So I guess the point is, and we use this term, or the Fed uses this term, long and variable lags, right, of monetary policy. Well, if all of a sudden you go from rate cuts going from 6 to 3 to 1 to 0 to maybe pricing in hikes because inflation is stoked by some geopolitical event, something we haven't seen. Guy, I said this on Fast Money last night, and I'm just curious. We didn't really bat it around. We're talking about, okay, so the Fed has lots of room to cut, right? In the event that we have a weakening economy or something like that.
Yes, because I know what you're saying. In the scope of, we have had zero interest rates before. Yeah. So in that context, the answer is theoretically yes. Continue.
My point was that in both instances, I remember in the last couple rate hiking cycles, we're like, well, this gives the Fed more room. We did not have inflation at levels.
There you go.
There you're going to go. And then the one point I was going to make about 2001, about 2007-08, and then obviously about 2020, the thing that caused them to cut dramatically was something that nobody could have foreseen. And so that's the one issue that I think, again, I think the Fed's in a much more difficult spot right now, even with Fed funds at 5.5%, because of the inflationary backdrop that we have. And then this is a great conversation that we had with David Rosenberg of Rosenberg Research last week. And I don't know, Danny, if you had a chance to listen to it. But the point is, he keeps harping on valuations, and he's probably right. But 99% of the market watchers out there are saying, what are you talking about? 21 times. We just had the Fed ratchet up their expectations for GDP. The U.S. is the best neighborhood and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You know, all that sort of stuff. But it's the things that we can't foresee. And I'm not saying that you have to start trading against the unknowns, but make no mistake about it. Things are expensive and the backdrop is fragile.
Listen, I was obviously being sarcastic when I made the comment about the jobs number, because I look at it this way. Let's make it more extreme. Let's make it 250 or 150.
Yeah.
250. Well, Fed rate cuts get pushed out, but guess what? The economy is still strong. It supports current valuations. 150, to your point. Oh, rate cuts get pulled forward, but hold on. Maybe the market is expensive, but does a Fed rate cut really, quote, do anything? Mm-hmm. And so that's the point that I'm making. And that the point that I'm making is you got to use those opportunities of those massive swings of either those numbers to cull in or to expand your portfolio based upon that stuff. That's my point, is that it's really ridiculous, but you have to pay attention to it.
Well, no, the market absolutely trades on it. And I'll be crystal clear. I was somebody that thought last year that into the fall of last year, you'd start to see a meaningful uptick in the unemployment rate. That did not happen. As a matter of fact, at one point, either earlier this year or late last year, it actually ticked down. But you go and look at the numbers, and now you think 10 out of the last 12 months, revisions have been significantly negative. At a certain point, that's going to catch up. And you did see the unemployment rate tick up the last reading.
Yeah,
I don't think the market is prepared, just my opinion, for a significant move. When I say significant move, a stair-step move higher in the unemployment rate, because I think the initial reaction would be, oh, that's good. That's going to give the Fed some cover. But then the reality is going to be, wait a second. This is a market. This is an economy that's predicated on, one, people having jobs, two, those people having access to credit, which, by the way, has been contracting, and three, those people spending money because they feel good about things. So throw that in a mixer and see what comes up, because I'm telling you, rate cuts are not going to assuage the concerns of those people.
All right, let's bring it back to the stock market here for a second here and some maybe individual names. Guy, you just mentioned that March 8th period. Okay, so we're coming on maybe a month. And what was going on there, it was like the height of the AI, AI frenzy, specifically in the semiconductor stocks. You talked about that intraday reversal, seemingly for no reason. I remember there was some options activity. There was a huge roll in NVIDIA, meaning somebody was taking some profits on some calls and rolling them up and out. And whatever happened on the backside of that caused a reversal. And it was this snowball effect, right? So it was maybe a dealer hedging, but then other folks saw some selling, and then they just started selling everything else in the space. You had NVIDIA close down 10% from its intraday highs, which was amazing. And I think you and I both tried to put a bit of a fine point on that. A few weeks later, we were kind of threatening those levels, but we didn't break out and we didn't make new highs. Well, here we are today on this reversal day. And I think it's important to note that AMD has had a 10% intraday reversal. Yeah. It's down 7.5%, 8% or so. NVIDIA is down 2.5%. And so to me, what's happened in this period is that you might have seen a broadening out away from some of the semis that have driven a lot of these early gains in 2024. But right now, those are still going to be the leadership, in my opinion. So I think that analogy, Guy, is a really good one. Just intraday, we've seen Microsoft sell off 2%. We've seen Google sell off 2.5%. We've seen Tesla, which was up at one point over 5%, is up a little less than 2% or something. So some very big, big moves in some of the biggest names in the market. And you could say, oh, well, energy is hanging in there and financial and banks are hanging in there and this and that, whatever. They just don't add up. Doesn't matter.
Let me just say this again. So as you mentioned, we do this on Thursdays. You can hear it on a Friday. So it was March 8th was a Friday as well. And I've been pretty consistent about this. And thank you for bringing it up. That day for technicians, people that chart things and look at the things through basically patterns that have been prevalent throughout the history of charting, they see certain patterns. The pattern that we saw specifically that day on NVIDIA, and I mention it because at the time it traded up to, I think, a market cap of north of $2.3 trillion or so. The reversal on that Friday from peak to trough, that stock lost almost $250 billion of market cap. For context, I think there are only 60 or 65 companies in the world that have a market cap of that size in the first place. But somehow it seemed normal to most people. And I've been flagging that ever since. And you also mentioned the fact that there were a couple days where we seemingly challenged that prior high on that day. Yep. But we never got there. And as we're sitting here today, we're almost $100-ish lower than that intraday high on March 8th. That is something to watch. That has not been broken. And I will say again, we might come back here 2 months from now and say, holy shit, guys, you were right about that March 8th intraday reversal. And we're seeing it now in broader market reversals. So when you see extreme moves like this, that is typically indicative of something going on. And again, as we're sitting here, I'm watching the VIX now tick up north of 16, Danny Moses. So it's clear that something is in the works.
You know, I forgot to mention to you guys yesterday, I had the benefit of spending the day with the one and only Mike Wilson from Morgan Stanley, who was down in Florida with some Morgan Stanley private client guys that I know when his flight was delayed. So we had, you know, kind of a heart-to-heart over a beer, and we kind of looked at each other, and I said, I'm going to tell you what I got wrong. You tell me what you got wrong. And to the point you made, Guy, a few minutes ago about a recession or job slowing, I said to Mike, plain and simple, I go, in the fall of last year, I was so convinced that by the second quarter of 2024, and maybe by the first quarter, that we would certainly see signs of a recession, signs of economic slowdown, and dead wrong. And so if that's the thesis that lends it. Now, that being said, the other thing that we talked about was private credit. And I know it's talked about ad nauseum. We don't have to go into it. People know who the players are in it. God bless them all. Owl Rock, Blackstone, Apollo, Ares, all these guys. Great. Deploying. The Fed actually wrote a great article on it. I want to say in February, we'll put it in the show notes, the size of this market. It's the other thing that I underestimated. And he admitted that he underestimated the power that the non-bank financial system has had and still has. And by the way, I'll tell you, these are covenant light. It is what it is, but you won't see any problems with those loans probably unless we go into a recession. So I wanted to highlight those two things. And the last thing I want to say about Mike Wilson, and I asked for permission to talk about this, is he decided to go to the airport at 5 o'clock yesterday in Fort Lauderdale. When I told him the Met game's canceled, you're probably not getting into LaGuardia. I think you're making a mistake. You should stay. He landed at 3 a.m. in LaGuardia. So he'll admit he made a major error on that part. So anyway, I wanted to kind of round that out in this conversation.
We all make errors. And let me say this real quick. Heart to heart for you fans out there of the show, the great Robert Wagner, who, by the way, is still with us at 94 years of age. Dan, I know you were a fan of that show. And of course, Stephanie Powers played his wife, Jennifer Hart. Yeah. You don't care. Maybe we'll cut this out. Please don't. But if you're looking for individual names on everything that Danny just was talking about and I was mentioning, I still believe in my heart of hearts that gold GDX or the miners, either Newmont Mining, Agnico Eagle Mines, or what Danny mentions it all the time, PHYS, which as we sit here, I think is at its all-time high. Those are underappreciated. Again, a stock market that's effectively, today notwithstanding, at its all-time high, the underlying commodity at its all-time high, and some of these gold miners are still half of their prior all-time high. So the catch-up trade in these mining stocks, I believe, Dan Nathan, is going to be fast and furious.
Yeah, but listen, can we just break this out for
break
a second?
Break it out,
so
baby.
When I listened to David Einhorn yesterday with Wapner, okay, to me, what was really evident is that this is a calamity trade, okay? So David Einhorn has talked about, so Greenlight Capital, you know, he's missed some moves like the rest of us here and there or whatever. And so not only is he loading up on GLD, he's loading up on gold bars. He's it's not like buying a stock because you think the prospects are better. You're buying this risk asset because you think something else is going to go pear-shaped.
Fair.
So when I think about the miners, Guy, okay, I say to myself, well, these are operating companies. Mm-hmm. These are companies that need to get orders or whatever the hell it is, right? Like this, that, whatever. They have expenses, they have input costs, they're subject to interest rates. I find the miners much less interesting than buying the calamity trade. And right here, I think the miners are up about 20%. Is that so? From those recent lows or whatever. I'd probably rather buy Bitcoin for the reasons that you guys are saying to be long of gold here. Because to me, if there is a calamity trade, then it's going to be expressed in that sort of. The GDX may go up. You know, we talked about silver earlier in the week in the market call. That may go up too, but they're really representing something different, right? Like to me, they're it's kind of like the CDS trade in a way.
I would say that I hear that point, but I would say that the Bitcoin has a lot more retail exposure and kind of fast money exposure than gold does. It's not to say both can't be volatile, but Bitcoin's going to have a lot more volatility, and the stock stands surrounding crypto that we've talked about, you know, the Coinbases of the world, right, that are kind of out there, the miners themselves for Bitcoin miners themselves, that whole group is very, very volatile. So certainly you can play that way. I just feel like you're looking for a lot more volatility, that if things do calm down again, those may sell off a lot more than gold at these levels, just from a supply-demand perspective. But point well taken.
Yeah, no, but I wouldn't buy those stocks for those reasons. I would equate those Bitcoin proxies as the miners in a way. And the one thing I'll just say, earlier in the week when we had that nasty sell-off, there was a one-day NASDAQ, I know it's nasty, it was down 1% or something like that. Did you see that Bitcoin was down 7%? So it seems to be very positively correlated to the semi-gen AI trade and that sort of thing. So to me, that's the one differential. Your gold is the pure play.
Danny Moses, earlier I mentioned in a very loud and vociferous way that I'm no fan of Neil Kashkari, and there are a number of reasons why. There's another person that I've really never been a fan of. I don't underestimate her intelligence. I don't underestimate her want to do good, but I find her to be ponderous at best and just annoying at worst. And that individual is headed over to China, oddly enough. Thoughts on the great Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen?
She's actually in China. I think it was planned. But again, I always find this coordination when rates start to move up. What's her job? Her job is to issue the debt of the government and to keep rates at bay, and Powell's to keep everybody calm. So there's a method to the madness here. And she's in China and basically going after them, as we have been, threatening tariffs potentially, to say, you guys are making stuff too cheap, like solar or electric vehicle, and you're exporting them and you're killing everyone else's business. I don't agree with any of the politics in China. Let me just separate that for a second. But when we were big into globalization and all the U.S. multinationals had factories, or still do, in China, and the low cost, it was so deflationary at the time, and it's great, and everybody. Now we're hammering them for the fact that they're trying to grow their economy and do things. They can survive and make money, and we're coming after them for that. It's a lot deeper than that. I'm just kind of pointing out the obvious here. So she's on a five-day run there. But let's talk about China's ownership of U.S. treasuries, Japan's ownership of U.S. treasuries. China has dropped from, I think, 11.6% of foreign U.S. treasuries to 9.9%. It's still a lot, but it's dropping. Same with Japan, it's dropping. U.K. is growing, Canada's growing. We need these countries, though. We can only push them so far, right? China, we need to still basically own our stuff and help us. So we have to be partners with them in some capacity. I think this is an important timing perspective in the sense of how much debt we do have to actually issue and how important that relationship is, both from a economic perspective as a partner. We can hate them all we want, but they're our partner in a lot of economic activity. So we'll see what happens. I don't know how effective it's going to be, but the last thing you should want if you're worried about inflation, in my opinion, is tariffs and hard talk on Chinese manufacturing and so forth, because that's only going to increase our costs. Again, I'm playing the long game. I want what's right in the world. I'm happy to favor the U.S. in that regard. But just think about the implications on that in terms of the economics of it. That's
well, it's interesting you mentioned that, because earlier this week on CNBC's Fast Money, great show, Dan Nathan.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
5 p.m. Eastern time.
Yeah, Monday through Friday.
We had Stephen Roach on the show, he's probably forgotten more about China than 99.5% of the population. And Tim Seymour correctly, and if Tim didn't do it, I would have done it, asked him a question along that vein, along those lines, in terms of, you know, is she there basically to talk about issuance and their ability to basically buy our debt and those types of things. And he seemingly dismissed it a bit. Now, again, I'm not suggesting he's right or wrong, but, you know, he didn't think it was that big a deal. I happen to agree with you, Danny Moses. Like, I believe that one of the reasons she's over there is exactly that. I don't think that's something that comes out in terms of the notes or ever how they position it. But it's clearly something that's got to be top of mind, because we're at a point now in April of 2024 where I still believe there's about $9 trillion worth of issuance that needs to come to market over the next, I don't know, 9 or 10 months. People will buy our debt. But to your point, Danny, it's the rate at which they buy our debt that's important. And with these issuances coming, I get the feeling these bond auctions, again, just my opinion, are going to get worse and worse.
Listen, one other sector which we can talk about, which, you know, we talk about why you should care about government debt, deficits, and so forth, is obviously you saw what happened in the healthcare stocks, United Healthcare, Humana, on this Medicare reimbursement rate. Instead of going up, was flat year over year. Humana stock was down how much? 15-20%, guy, or something in that realm.
Well, I mean, real quick, in terms of Humana, and I'm glad you brought that up, not a small company. Even with the sell-off, this is still a $38 billion company. And I say, even with the sell-off, this was a stock that I think at one point was north of $550, I think, in the fall of 2022. you started to have a sell-off and then an additional sell-off on the back of this news. And now you're talking about a stock that's either side of $310. And you throw on top of that a name like UNH and some of these other names in the space. And that's obviously having an impact, but please continue.
No, my point is that you've got to start to think about these things and the impact. Industries and sectors that are reliant on government spending, at least to a degree, that's how sensitive this can be. So if we start to, you know, increase taxes, I'm really getting out in the future here in terms of how we're going to fix this fiscal problem that we might have that we don't care about at the moment. And that's fine. You don't have to care. But you care when you own Humana and you own the Dow, and United Healthcare obviously is a huge component of it because we know that's a bad index. Anyway, but my point is that start paying attention to these things because they're going to matter more and more.
Now, lest you folks think I'm negative about everything, Neil Kashkari and Janet Yellen and the fate, all this stuff, okay? I'm not. I'm not a hater, Dan Nathan. As a matter of fact, like 12 million other citizens in this country, I watched the Iowa Hawkeyes women team beat the LSU Tigers women team to get into the Final Four. 12 million. Did you hear that number?
12.
Why do I mention? Because that is a staggering number, Danny Moses. The women's game, in my opinion, I'll watch them play every single day over the men. With that said, there are things happening in terms of the gambling sector that lends itself to these conversations and to some of the viewership over the last couple weeks, D-Mo.
Yes. While I was away, there was some, I guess, some news out on the sector that various states want to ban gambling on individual prop bets in college, right? And there's some scrutiny coming in and what gambling is doing. Certainly gambling can be a problem for people, but the sector had run so much, it was a good, you know, I guess it was a good excuse for some profit taking. That being said, it's still in a big sector bull story. You guys know how I felt about these names for a long time, the Flutter, which is FanDuel, DraftKings, and Genius Sports, which I'll get into in a second. But bottom line is that game guy that you're talking about that had 12 million eyeballs on it at least was the most wagered game in women's sports history. But not only that, it showed a sign that women are also getting involved in the gambling. And FanDuel, you know, basically said so. So it was a huge, just kind of, I think, coming out party and just gives you an idea how big this market can be. So the stocks have started to recover from some of that, you know, sell off that had occurred. And one name in particular, which reported earnings recently and has had a huge overhang because a large private equity owner has been selling, is Genius Sports, GENI. Without going, you guys know how I feel. I've talked about it, you know, this name obviously on the show before, about a $1.3 billion market cap, $120 to $530 million in cash, going to do $75 million in EBITDA. So it's not that expensive. It is the AI play for data in sports. It has the NFL, English Premier League. I'll leave it at that. But there's been a cast on the stock away from the markets just because there's been a large seller who just finally sold a huge stake and they're down below 10% finally. So that's a name that I would buy on weakness that has come into the entire sector, GENI. But I'm still very bullish on the sector overall. There's not many sector growth areas in this economy that are going to be producing this type of tax revenue, I believe, for the country. So
on this reversal day, as we mentioned, again, this is Thursday as we're taping, Friday as you're listening, DraftKings is positive. And this stock, Dan Nathan, quickly has been lower left to upper right since December of 2022, when it was, as you say, a very large hat size. So I still think there's room in the space. Now, before we go to the great Ben Callow, either one of you have anything you'd like to get off your mind regarding Tesla before we get into what will be a very interesting conversation? Dan, you first.
If you are sick of us talking about Tesla, there's a couple things. The fundamental story was an important one. It was a big technology narrative, right? It was about AI before we started talking about generative AI. That was full self-driving. It was about this, the transformation of the, you know, electric grid. It was, you know, how all of these, you know, ICE manufacturers were going to be forced to kind of go the way of Tesla. It was going to be about China. It was going to be about low ends. It was going to be about robo-taxis. It was like a lot of really big, highfalutin tech narratives were wrapped up into the story, not to mention the cult following that Elon Musk has, right? And then if you want to go, I mean, Danny's detailed this for 3 years on the show, corporate governance. I mean, the list goes on and on and on, right? There was, it had a little something for everybody. And the fact of the matter is the story has come undone, in my opinion. Could it get worse? Of course. Could it get incrementally better? Sure. And I probably see a long-term horizon where this company probably starts to get some things right. I said it on Fast Money, Guy, the night we were talking about that delivery disaster that they did. I said, it's interesting that Elon Musk, who's been universally anointed the best CEO this world has ever seen, like, has actually made some massive, massive errors over the last few years about how he's run this company, both on a micro level and from a macro perspective, in my opinion. So that's why this story has been fascinating to me. I think that's why we've talked about it a lot. So that's it. And then some of the other things that you think we harp on a lot, I'm just going to tell you this. I think we're going to end up being right about the narratives about the thing, but you can be wrong on price. You can be right on fundamentals and it hurts, but you know what? That's what makes a podcast, people, because we're not here trying to take your money to run a hedge fund or be your financial advisor or anything like that. So I'll kick it over to you, Danny, because I know that you've been fascinated with the story and you've been very active in it for years.
Ben's done a great job. He came out a couple of weeks ago previewing how bad Q1 could be, even going into Q2 in terms of deliveries, what that could look like, and knows that there's issues. The one analyst I have an issue with is Adam Jonas at Morgan Stanley, which everybody kind of knows. He's been the outspoken bull kind of on the name and non-apologetic. Well, let me just be clear where he is now with his numbers that he's come out. And he made a very interesting comment. He is now, if I'm not mistaken, on a GAAP earning 66 cents for 2024 and $1.58 for 2025. But here's what's interesting, Dan. Auto sales in 2023, the auto sales line for Tesla, were around $82 billion. He is now, Adam Jonas, at $77 billion. So you think about that number going down, and in 2025 down to 90. But here's his quote, which I take total issue with. We believe Tesla has significant attributes to be valued as an AI beneficiary, but the company must see a stabilization in the negative earnings revision within the auto business first. We do not believe that Tesla will get credit as an AI company as long as its core auto earnings are being revised down. What? So is he saying basically they've lost credibility with the investment community because the auto business has deteriorated? Because one should really, at the end of the day, have nothing to do with the other. So my point is that now people are grasping for excuses on what it may be. Well, it would have been a good AI story and you could have believed in it if auto line had done better. So my point is, it's all bullshit. So Jonas's auto valuation, I think, is $62 per share, whatever it might be. So again, Ford up 12.5% for the year, GM up 25% for the year. We told people, you want auto exposure? Go buy those guys at the end of 2023, we said. You want tech? Go buy one of these tech high flyers instead of dealing, your point, Dan, about this, what has really become a mess. So it's turned into a show me story. If you still own Tesla, God bless you, you know, hope it works out for you. You do not own it for fundamental reasons right now. Okay. I'm still short. I'm still there. We'll see how it plays out. But we had a great conversation with Ben.
This was an animated conversation and I enjoyed it a great deal. I hope you folks did as well. But I encourage you to stick around because after this very short break, we'll have a conversation with the aforementioned Ben Callow from R.W. Baird. See you on the other side. With CME Group's micro-sized futures and options, you can access the same transparency and liquidity of the benchmark contracts with less upfront financial commitment. Diversify your portfolio and manage your exposure with the flexibility of CME Group micro-contracts in crypto, metals, FX, energy, and equity indices. Learn more about what adding futures can do for you at cmegroup.com/micros. iConnections is the world's largest capital introduction platform in the alternative investment industry. iConnections membership-only platform brings together the asset management community, providing allocators and managers with the opportunity to connect both physically and virtually. With an impressive network of over 4,000 allocators and 900 managers, their community oversees an astounding $48 trillion and $16 trillion in assets, respectively. iConnections is also the driving force behind the alternative investment industry's most renowned in-person events. We invite you to join iConnections at their upcoming event, Salt iConnections in New York, taking place on May 20th through the 21st at the Glass House in New York City. This two-day event is packed with one-on-one cap intro meetings and content. To explore more about iConnections events and gain access to their members-only platform, visit iConnections.io. Trading options might be new for you, or maybe you've been doing it for a while. Either way, Fidelity is your go-to source for clear and relevant information about trading options. For example, ask Fidelity professionals questions during their live small classes and coaching sessions and learn more with educational videos, articles, and webinars. Plus, with Fidelity's straightforward tools and technology, you'll find it easier than ever to trade options your way. See what's waiting for you at fidelity.com/options. Options trading entails significant risk and is not appropriate for all investors. Certain complex option strategies carry additional risks. Before trading options, contact Fidelity Investments by calling 800-544-5115 to receive a copy of Characteristics and Risks of Standardized Options. Supporting documentation for any claims, if applicable, will be furnished upon request.
Welcome back to the On The Tape podcast. Guy, Danny, myself, with a very special guest this week. We don't frequently have too many analysts join us on the program, but we thought, given what went on this week in a kind of important stock, at least one in our coverage, that would be Tesla, we wanted to bring back to the pod Ben Callow. He's managing director at Baird, who's been covering Tesla for as long as I've known him, or as long as I've covered the stock. Ben, welcome back to the pod.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
All right, this is the portion, if we have been triggering you since we started this pod, I think, what was it, January of 2021, about our conversations in and around Tesla, click off, go do something else, have fun. We're going to get deep into Tesla in a little bit about those Q1 deliveries and what Ben sees for the balance of the year. Some of just the narratives in and around the EV story, we wanted to broaden out a little bit because he covers a lot of stocks in the space and we want to hit some things like lithium too. So we want to hit all of that. So really stick around. Don't go do something else here. All right, guys, let's get into it. Ben, just give us the 411 a little bit on what you saw out of the company as far as deliveries, what you expect for the balance of the year. And really importantly, this is a story that you've liked long-term for a while here. But in January of this year, when the stock was much higher, you went to, I think, what you call a fresh bearish pick. So this is something you were out in front of many analysts on the street about what you were expecting in the near term and for the balance of the year. So we want to get to what really prompted that fresh bearish pick in January also.
Two different things. And our bearish fresh pick, just for listeners, is more of a tactical thing. We can do a bearish fresh pick or we can do a bullish fresh pick. And we put a bearish fresh pick a couple months ago. And really, it was twofold. It was when Musk lost his case about his pay package. That was one of the things we thought would be an overhang on the stock because he was basically saying that he would take his ball and go play elsewhere as it was concerned to AI. And then it really what was important, what was a second part of our thesis there for the bearish fresh pick, was that delivery numbers were too high at that point. And so we started ratcheting them down. Throughout the quarter, they ran into some one-time production issues. Number one, Red Sea entanglement there, hurting the supply chain. Number two, this year, the Lunar New Year fell into February. So there was a shutdown in China that affected production there. They did refresh the Model 3 first in China last year, but then started to do it in Fremont, where they produced the Model 3, Fremont, California. And that's taken them longer to ramp the Model 3 here in the U.S. than expected. And then there was the arson from the environmentalists that burned down the substation there attached to the Berlin plant. So those were all production issues. Street numbers were still stale, too high, so we got more vocal on it. And ultimately, heading into the quarter, we started getting data about weakness across all geographies in sales. And although we didn't see price cuts like we did last year, at least to the extent that we did, last year was just riddled with price cuts as they tried to increase volume. There was really only one price cut across geographies in the first quarter. And then we hit deliveries this week. And even though street numbers came down, it was still a big miss. We held our pick into the delivery number. And so I think people were bracing for 410, 415 in deliveries. And they actually did, 380, 88. And so it was a big miss. Now, following that, one of the things on the delivery release is the production was up at 435. And so this is the biggest difference in deliveries and production, both on an absolute basis and on a percentage basis that we have seen in the 10, 11 years that we've covered Tesla.
So Ben, this seems to be a demand issue, not a supply issue. As you noted, the gap between production delivery numbers that are there. You came out prior to the quarter and lowered those numbers to under 420,000, I believe, around that area. It came in, obviously, 387. And the street's still pretty high for Q2, Q3, Q4, and the ramp. What is the street not seeing that you're seeing that leads you to be a little bit more bearish? And what could really reaccelerate this delivery number and get people excited that this thing's going to return to some type of growth story?
We still think that the street, there's still risk in the stock because the Q2 numbers are too high. I think some of it is just numbers are stale out there. And, you know, people are modeling a year-over-year growth. We actually think that's risk to the stock because I think Q2 could be another down quarter year-over-year for them. One of the things I think that people read as a positive, back in early March, Tesla said, buy a Model Y now because we're going to raise price on April 1st, $1,000. And they did that in the U.S. and other geographies. And so I think that got some people more bullish about the demand in Q2 and onwards throughout the year. What we saw just yesterday is they're actually providing 0% financing in China. It's not a direct price cut, but it is a price cut in another way of doing it. So still think there's risk in those numbers there. What people are excited about, this is the question, as we talk to investors, are people looking through this bad year into next year when the next generation vehicle comes online, when you have more AI, full self-driving becomes higher attach rates. I think there's still risk with those numbers though. And I do think people are still debating whether it's demand issue. And I don't think that there's really a debate right now. And it's not just for Tesla. We saw this at BYD numbers and other numbers as well on the electric vehicle side. And so it's not just a Tesla problem. It's an overall problem.
Ben, I'm not asking you to comment on other analysts' work, but Wedbush had a note out earlier this week talking about a turning point for the company, a disaster in terms of deliveries, a lot of hyperbolic language being used. But my question to you is something that I've struggled with in trying to understand. How important is the China portion of this Tesla story to the overall, obviously, demand in terms of what happens with margins and obviously then in turn what happens with the stock?
Very important. You think about a third of their cars at least sold there in China. This is a Musk has been on the record every call saying this, at least the last three or four calls, saying where we really see competition. Go back 10 years, there was always competition, the Tesla killers. But he's always talked about China being the real source of competition. BYD and others, I think that's what was showing up in the numbers here, along with other things.
You just mentioned a 0% financing in China here, and Elon Musk over the last year and a half has made comments about interest rates on many occasions, right? And so you've had all these price cuts over the last 2 years or so. I think a lot of consumers are pretty confused about the pace in which the prices have come down, and then obviously interest rates have gone up. So it's made these cars very expensive, right, relative to many others. And one of the things that I just keep coming back to is that we haven't even had a difficult economy yet. If you think back to 2020, the last time that they had two consecutive negative quarters of delivery growth. And so I just wonder here, if we are higher for longer, he spent a lot of time over the last year talking about $125,000 Cybertruck, right, to get the cult member or the bros or whoever really excited about this thing. And they're making $400 a week, right? Rather than focused on the $25,000 mass market EV that has always been the promise, right, for this company. So talk to us a little bit about the notion that maybe they've literally taken their eye off the ball about what's most important to this story. And I wonder if they've just really miscalculated on some major issues, whether it be competitive, whether it be products, whether it be macro, whether it be price elasticity. There's just a lot of things that seems that this company has massively mis-executed on.
There's a lot there, Dan. First of all, Cybertruck, I think number one is, you know, we think that demand will be higher than expected for as they ramp production. This year is going to be a drag on margin. We model about $700 billion loss on production throughout the year as they ramp up to over 100,000 vehicles. I do think it creates a halo effect. You have Kim Kardashian, others out there, movie stars out there driving these Cybertrucks. I think that helps parking in front of a Tesla store, help bring people in to see it. I also think that it's important technology they're using to make the Cybertruck that will be used in the next generation vehicle. Now, I do think that there's fair criticism that it's over-engineered. It's become a science project of Musk to do this Cybertruck. And there is a gap between the Model S, 3, X, and Y, which are really the real underpinnings of revenue, and this next generation vehicle, which is expected second half of next year. But likely, if we use past timelines, it's probably more of a 26 story. And then that puts us in a position where we might have another flat to down year next year, too, especially as they invest $10 billion CapEx and multi-billion dollars in R&D into AI, into this next generation platform. This year is a gap year. The question now is next year a gap year as well.
So Ben, what I've noticed is obviously when stocks, any growth story starts to not trade higher on growth announcements, what do we mean? Or we may go into India, we're going into Mexico, growth. And when that stops working, that's always a sign that the stock is either devolving into what it might become, which is currently an auto company. So my question is twofold. One is, I know that FSD continuously is on the come. They're now basically giving it away. Certain analysts like yourself are using some type of attachment rate to decide, okay, what could that long-term value be? I'm curious how you come up with 12,000. And my second is that to use an EBITDA number on this company for a target, I'm not singling you out. I'm saying in general, 30 times EBITDA discounting back. Shouldn't it be an earnings story at this point, especially as it looks more and more, at least near term, like an auto company? I'm just curious on your current sum of the parts.
I think that that's actually the biggest risk to the stock right now is on the multiple, not the deliveries this year, but how the frame of how it's viewed. And we're at a position where the risk is all of that great stuff on the come, which they're doing very interesting things that will be very important to the economy, to growing revenue, is so far away. Does it just become an auto multiple now? And do people look at that and say, it's still expensive because I have to wait through 2 years of flat earnings, which would now be 3 years after last year. And so that multiple compression, I think, is the big worry, not whether Q2 numbers are too high. That's the ultimate worry if it breaks down even more.
Ben, I think it was, and you can correct me, please, but I think it was the fall of 2022 where Elon Musk came out and told investors in Wall Street that, listen, our margins just start to contract. We're not going to get to legacy auto levels, which is 16.5%, but we're going to start to move lower from there. I think low 20s, I think it was 23% or so. And the street took that into consideration. And I want to say it was April or May of 2023 when the street thought, okay, trough margins, this is going to be the reacceleration. The stock acted in kind. I think it went from, I don't know, 175 to 300 or so, not in a straight line, but pretty quickly. What we've come to learn, though, there has been no real margin expansion. I mean, margins are sort of hovering around those levels that we troughed at. Is there a trough margin coming to a theater near you, or do we still have some room to the downside? Because you see a demand problem, as you sort of addressed. We're still trying to figure that out. And obviously, there have been price cuts significantly along the way.
Perversely, this quarter could be trough margins because they're so bad, because you have those one-time issues in production. It's going to be a messy quarter. Everyone's bracing for that. But Guy, I still don't know if anyone could say that's definitely trough margins going forward at this point. The real question, though, I think is, do people want to own the stock for the future and say, forget, get these two quarters a wash, or, you know, economy gets better, or they pick up sales by advertising. They're starting to do advertising now. We've heard lots of investors say, rather than do $1,000 price cuts across, call it 2 million vehicles, that's $2 billion. Go spend a couple hundred million dollars on advertising and then drive demand. And that goes back to Dan's question about elasticity, because I'm not sure that anyone really knows that cutting price by $1,000 actually helps spur demand. We don't know that for sure, or if it's just, they're just losing money doing it.
So one of the real threats, or what's going on in the market share world, is hybrids. And if you look at Ford, GM, it's specifically Ford, what's going on with their numbers. Ford's up 12.5% year to date. GM's up 25% year to date. If you're a portfolio manager looking at the quote sector, and you do want to put this kind of in the auto, and you can do tech in other ways, we know there's a lot of AI quote plays that are out there. When you're talking to institutional investors right now, what are the questions that they're coming in? Are they effectively not giving up, but reassessing where they are? What kind of transition are we in as far as ownership of the stock in the institutional community that you talk to?
I think that we're in no man's land right now, where there's a lot of wait and see. I think that what we saw the week before deliveries, when the full self-driving leaked email came out and that everyone's going to get it for a month, the stock got a little bump. There was some probably positioning around deliveries, so covering before deliveries, because the stock was down significantly ahead of that still. But I think that was really retail. If you look at the volume, it was very low volume in those days. And so I think there's a lot of just head scratching. I don't want to touch it right now going on. Now, there's been a lot of people that have under-owned it in their benchmark that have been burned on it on the way up too. And so there's a little bit of a gun shy going on as well, where, like, do we need to own this because all of a sudden Elon's going to pull a rabbit out of its his hat, and we're going to be in pain again, as it's a big part of the S&P or in all benchmarks. And so it is really a no man's land, though, right now.
So, Ben, before we move to other things, I'd love just to get your sense. So the stock, as we're recording right now, is $170. It's $540 billion in market cap. It's obviously been more than cut in half from its late 21 highs. And I think it's pretty clear that after they report, you know, 2024 estimates are going to come down, right? It's going to be a down year over year EPS story. 2025 is likely to come down. You just acknowledged yourself that this low end EV is going to be pushed into 2026. So to keep a half a trillion dollar market cap, you're going to have a lot of this other AI stuff, FSD, all that really stuff that, again, lots of stocks in the public markets are trading at really great multiples on because of the promise of what they're investing in, what they're doing. At some point, this Tesla story is going to morph into that in a very true manner when I think investors just recognize the fact that they are basically an auto company that has this other potential. So my question to you, if this stock was down, let's say 25% in the next 3 to 6 months, discount again, a down 2024, a down 2025, and then maybe, okay, to me, it would look like a really good do at $125 or something like that. Is that something that, let's say, real institutional investors, not these folks that we see on Twitter, the retail sort of folks, is there an institutional crowd that believes in what I just laid out? Is that the bull case for this story about why you want to own it?
You hit it right on the head. Tesla is investing in, I do think at one point they'll start breaking out their CapEx and their R&D into AI. And right now, I think that there's a view from institutional investors that we're waiting to see this because the market's not assigning value right now to all of this investment that's being made that, you know, that will, in my view, be, you know, a big move for revenue and for the stock.
Ben, you have a coverage universe outside of Tesla, and there's a lot of interesting things going on. So let's pivot away and talked about some of the things you're excited about. I know lithium, there's some secular stories out there. Lithium might be one of them. Thoughts on that?
Everyone's searching for the bottom on it. Prices just cratered. You're starting to get to a position where you're having small miners close up shop. And so you're getting help from the supply side as supply gets reduced to the market. And then in the background, we read all the time about these and no one wants them and Hertz is not going to rent them anymore. And there's a lot underlying that. But if you look at the data, there's still growth in the U.S. There's still growth in Europe. And in fact, in China, year over year for Q1, these sales were up over 30%. And so I think the combination of demand still being there and supply coming in and a lot of the lithium companies postponing CapEx will help bring the supply-demand equation back together. And I think they're set. The stocks are set to go higher.
Let's talk about Rivian for a second here. This is a company that is losing a lot of money. They have a lot of cash. We know that they have some interesting investors that are also like their customers too. It reminds me the story a little bit of, let's say, Tesla 10 years ago. And you could make the case that they're going to run out of cash in a couple of years and they're fighting some really big competitors and their price point is really high. I think they just produced their 100,000th car. If you think about it, we just talked about Tesla delivering nearly 400,000 cars, expected to do 2 million this year or so. How do you think about a story like this? It's got an enterprise value of less than $6 billion. Is it almost a call option on diversification away from, let's say, Tesla and a focus on some higher end models? They're going to have a lot of competition with the Germans and the Koreans on the high end. But how do you think about this story? And when you talk to investors, do you kind of encourage them to diversify away from just Tesla? Because it's not just a pure play story on EVs anymore, which you could make the argument that a Lucid or a Rivian is.
First of all, I think one of the most important things about Rivian is its brand, and it's established its own following similar to what Tesla did 10 years ago and building off of that brand. And I think that we have a tough year ahead of us. They're retooling the factory, so it's going to be a flattish year in terms of deliveries. Now, it's kind of a good time for that with weak demand out there, so they don't build inventory. I think that it's important they have the Amazon relationship. They branched out that. They do have the Amazon support as a shareholder. And I do think it's one that people should own, but it's going to be a tough year. And really what they're trying to do is get gross margin profitable. And we won't see that until really Q4. And so that will be early next year results. So you got a long bridge there to cross. But I do think they will find money to fund their future. I think the R2 they showcased is a good looking car. I think that there are people out there that can't buy an $85,000 R1. at that price point, that will attract a much bigger audience. You know, it'll be small volumes at first, but it also will be a good competitor to the Model Y and the R2. So that's something also that we're thinking about as it comes out, but that's scheduled to come out in 2026. So we got a ways for that. But it is a company that I think will be around and will make it. There's some other ones out there that I think they will have a more difficult time making it and becoming a larger company.
Ben, within your coverage universe, you obviously cover a wide array of companies, ADM to First Solar. Maybe talk about some of the themes within those names and maybe just, again, go through some of your top picks and, you know, ignoring, you know, electric vehicles for a moment here.
What we call our group is a sustainable energy and mobility. I think the biggest theme that's occurring right now is that these technologies have become cost competitive. It's not just about reducing emissions. It's more about it's the cheapest and the best source of generating electricity. When you talk about solar and storage, a lot of that is because the industry is matured. And costs have come down substantially. Within solar, the real bright spot is utility scale solar. So rather than doing rooftop, doing a big utility scale on the ground mount, that's where First Solar plays. They have the biggest and really the only scaled footprint of manufacturing in the U.S. And so the Inflation Reduction Act provides tax credits for that. But they are also competitive just on their own technology basis. And then one that we just picked up, Nextracker, is basically tracking systems to position the panels as the sun moves or as hail comes and flattens out the panels so they don't get damaged. So there's very interesting technology going into that space. And there's a lot of development going on. It's really one of the big drivers of it, to take a step back, is all of the money going into AI is putting upward pressure on electricity prices. And so this is making a higher demand to build these renewable utility systems. And so those are two ways that we like to play that Nextracker and then for solar.
Ben, real quick, going back to the lithium story, because I am fascinated by it. Albemarle, which is not easy to say, it's equally difficult to spell. Now is everybody's darling into the fall of 2022. Since then, the stock is probably off some 60% or so. But seems like it's starting to find a bottom here. And again, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about one of the largest producers of lithium in the world outside of China. This seemingly has a secular story that I think the street is probably not paying enough attention to. Thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that one of the things that they did a poor job of is they were contracted as prices ran up and they had long-term contracts. They unwound the contracts and were more levered to spot prices of lithium as prices went down. But now they're levered to spot prices of lithium. We think that we're bottoming out here. It's good leverage there. They have diversified a group of resources, both in Chile, Australia, developing in the U.S., as well as they are fully integrated. So they take it out of the ground and they basically refine it into the different products that go into batteries. And so they have a good footprint there, their balance sheet with the deal. I think this is a good entry point for it.
All right, Ben Calla, we appreciate you coming on an important week and a preview of what Tesla's earnings are going to be in a few weeks from now. I think you can tell that we're trying to be a bit constructive on the story and trying to find what so many people love about it. But to us, still at $500 billion market cap, we don't think it's exactly discounting, you know what I mean, a lot of the kind of difficult times that might be ahead if we do have an EV winter, higher rates for longer, and a more difficult economy, coupled with an increasingly difficult geopolitical setup with China. So like that's kind of where we stand. I think Guy, Danny, and I are on the same page in this. But that said, you put a fresh bearish pick on this a few months ago when the stock was much higher. So we are going to be tracking your next move in this one because I think you got a great finger on the pulse as it relates to just not only the institutional sentiment, but also the resale sentiment as it relates to Tesla. So Ben, thanks for joining us on the pod.
Thank you guys very much. Always appreciate it.
Thanks again to our presenting sponsors, CME Group, iConnections, and FactSet. If you like what you heard, make sure you hit follow and leave us a review. It helps other people find the show, and we also want to hear from you. Email us at contact@riskreversal.com. Derivatives are not suitable for all investors and involve the risk of losing more than the amount originally deposited and any profit you might have made. This communication is not a recommendation or offer to buy, sell, or retain any specific investment or service.